60 and over? Now's the time to make your appointment for your booster dose against COVID-19. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to book your appointment online. To continue protecting yourself against COVID-19 and its variants, get a booster dose and keep following distancing measures, wearing a mask, and washing your hands. The booster dose, the best way to stay protected longer. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Hello, dear listeners. As of March 16th, CKUT Studios will be closed until further notice. The programming on our airwaves will consist of a mixture of recent CKUT archives, new pre-recorded segments, and other relevant special programming. Our upcoming funding drive will be postponed until further notice. Thank you for understanding that we are taking these measures to protect the health of our staff and community members. Love, CKUT.
Indigenous Action, where we dig deep into critical issues impacting our communities throughout occupied America.
This is an autonomous anti-colonial broadcast with unapologetic and claws-out analysis towards total liberation.
So take your seat by this fire and may the bridges, forts, and churches we burn together light our way.
Long ago, an ancient war chief counseled his people in the way they should go. He wisely told them that education was the ladder to success and happiness. Go, my son. Climb that ladder.
Go, my son. Go and climb the ladder. Go, my son. Go and earn your feather. Go, my son.
Why haven't you learned anything?
Man, that school shit is a joke. The same people who control the school system control the prison system and the whole social system ever since slavery. Know what I'm saying?
Amongst the others on the train, they called the Iron Horse. Another native fell victim to their holocaust. The devils came to the village post, and his priest stealing children from their homes, took and placed them in a school to erase them and undo what they labeled as savage. Before the gates of long dead, she had tossed in a pile like it was garbage stripped down from your customer type. Your skin scrubbed till it bleed, put his clothes in a fight, and various items replace him with ours. Give him a Bible, teach him to read, preach him indeed. If he speaks one word of his tongue, no song sung from the homeland. She learned as a young buck from an old sage in the village to a school made of brick. What they planned was to kill him, save the man was the model, sodomized by a priest. Traumatized, getting beat, cooling races when he eat. Many died cause they starved, no one notified. Buried in the yard for not following the cross. All offenses for my ancestors, your heart beats through me. They took his son from his home, yeah, they pulled him apart. They took a daughter from her home, they were forced to depart. Amongst the others on the train, they called the Iron Horse. Another native fell victim to their holocaust.
Sounds good. Forget, I'm not sure I could. They say time heals everything, but I'm still waiting.
Yate, welcome to Indigenous Action Podcast. Today we are going to be jumping into the discussion around education, forced assimilation, particularly boarding and residential schools, and the impacts, the ongoing sort of brutal genocidal legacy that has more recently evoked indigenous rage, but something that we all recognize is something that we have lived with and grown up with all of our lives. And so we're going to be exploring that topic.
We are also part of the Channel Zero Network, and we're just going to take a brief moment to listen to a promo.
From Embers is a show produced about anarchist ideas and practice across so-called Canada. Every week we spend about an hour going in-depth about ideas, histories, and ongoing struggles that we think are important. We're a part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. You can check it all out at fromembers.libsyn.com.
And we have finally, once again, our hosts, Bon and Anthony. And we have a great, awesome, consistent guest, recurring guest, Remy from First Seven joining us as well. So we're going to really dig right in. So if folks want to introduce themselves and provide some kind of welcoming, we do also, of course, want to make sure that as we're talking about the subject and it's been requested, as this information is being discussed and shared, a content warning. So please just be aware of that. You know, it feels weird giving that because, you know, our lives didn't come with a content warning. So, you know, this is something that I've grown up with, and I'll share a little bit more about that, I think, when we get into it. But I'll turn it over to y'all.
Okay, hello everyone. It's so great to be back on the mic. This is Bon here, and I'm saddened by the topic of our conversation today. I'm excited to provide some critical analysis and how we can understand that colonial violence and how it still exists today. And yeah, with the content warning thing, I'm like, my life is a content warning. Like, don't follow me, don't listen to me unless you have a strong heart. But that's kind of what we're going to talk about today. So thanks everyone for being here and joining us.
Okay, thank you for tuning in, everybody. It's great to be back. It's unfortunate it's on such a somber note, but it's a note that unfortunately has been riding strong in our communities for a very long time. I'm hard pressed to say in all the years of my life that I've encountered anyone that doesn't know the tragedy of the boarding schools and residential schools, and or more less talked about the idea of broken heart syndrome. And so let's get into it.
Just wanted to say what's up to everyone. My name is Remy from the Black Mesa area, Zitla Jean Danasha. So I'm happy to be a part of these conversations and share what I know and learn from everyone else here as well.
So we are going to get into a bit of the history. This won't be a full history of boarding in residential schools. There's a lot of books. There's a lot of documentaries already out there, and we'll provide some links and resources in the text providing or following this podcast. But we also wanted to sort of go around and get a sense of everybody's personal experiences because, you know, I think something that has been shared quite a bit on social media is that every Indigenous family has somebody who's gone through this. It's not an anomaly. It's something extraordinarily pervasive. And I do want to just put one more, not necessarily content warning, but more sort of like cultural heads up. For Diné people, we don't talk about those who have passed. We don't talk about, you know, deaths and burials lightly. And that context is sometimes uncomfortable to address regarding our cultural protocols. And so there are some things that I'll talk about, some things I won't talk about in these terms, and some language I'll use very intentionally just because of that. So the sensitivity regarding addressing these issues from a traditional cultural standpoint, from being Diné, is something that we take very carefully as well.
Okay, so just to get into a little bit of the history so we have a context to start this conversation, I'm going to just read an excerpt from the article that was published on the Indigenous Action website called Colonial Education is Still War, Indigenous Knowledge and Rage is Power. So I definitely recommend everyone to take a look at that. But again, we're just going to provide a little bit from that article to have a context for this conversation. So there was 215 remains of Indigenous children that were recently uncovered in a mass grave at a residential school in so-called Canada. And after that, a collective Indigenous rage was sparked to address this brutal legacy of colonial schools. And the community in so-called Canada had a team use ground penetrating radar to find those burial sites at Kamloops Residential School. And the survey team's findings were made public on May 27th. And since then, we know that a lot more findings have been made public. So there have been about 1,800 children found just in the 11 schools in so-called Canada. And we know that the strategy of the boarding schools and residential schools was part of the political and ideological war waged against Indigenous children and families. There was a U.S. policy against Indigenous peoples, and that shifted from outright annihilation to forced assimilation. And in 1885, Commissioner of Indian Affairs Hiram Price stated, "It is cheaper to give them education than to fight them." And then another colonial politician named Carl Schurz clarified the economics behind that strategy, and he said that it would cost $1 million to kill an Indian in warfare, whereas it only costs $1,200 to school an Indian child for 8 years. So as part of that shift in strategy from just outright annihilation to assimilation, Army General Richard Pratt then created the first government-funded off-reservation boarding school with the mission to kill the Indian, save the man. And so Pratt and other colonizers at that time made it really clear that this was a project of civilization, stating, "Transfer the savage-born infant to the surroundings of civilization, and he will grow to possess a civilized language and habit." So these white supremacist colonial school systems were designed explicitly and violently to impose Christian capitalist values to produce more productive members of the colonial social order. And we know that the violent military and Christian institutions of separation, forced assimilation, and extreme physical as well as sexual violence were very effective. And we know that that strategy was replicated by other colonial forces, obviously including so-called Canada.
Yeah, this is an important overview of part of the legacy and something that for a long time, as long as I've known, there's been organizing to address. I think, you know, there's the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. Initially, I think it was started as the Boarding School Healing Project. And there's a range of other groups that have advocated for a long time. So it's interesting to see that this moment that was sparked after the Kamloops School findings of this mass burial site, this mass grave, has sparked this powerful rage. And so I just wanted to share a little bit of where I come from, because, you know, as I mentioned before, I don't know anybody who hasn't been impacted by boarding schools here, you know, residential schools as they're known in so-called Canada. My father actually went to a boarding school, but only when he was 23. Like, he grew up on the res until, only speaking Dinepezad, only speak, practicing our traditional cultural ways, as folks are aware, as I've discussed before, he's a traditional Hatathli or medicine practitioner. And so he remembers, seeing his first white person, in traveling around on horse and cart or wagon when he was younger. And so when he was 23 years old, he was, compelled, or he was coerced to go to the Sherman Institute in Riverside, California. But he was already 23, so he was grown. And when people ask him about it, he says, oh, they just put me in the knowledge factory just so I could learn how to say yes or no. And he was one of those people who was just, forced to have a trade. But he was old enough at that time that he was one of the people that were there that actually looked after and took care of other younger people. So he helped to organize different clubs and stayed in the LA area after his boarding school experience to organize with the indigenous community there. So his story is different. Like when you publicly, when we've asked him to talk about that before, he doesn't want to talk about it. It's a hard thing to have a deep conversation with him about it, because it was extraordinarily traumatizing, but it also is complicated. This is something that so many folks were forced to endure. And so every single one of my aunts and uncles and my relatives all went to boarding school, and they all have different stories. Some of them ran away. My partner's father, he ran away like 3 or 4 times and has some really powerful, interesting stories about just returning home and that whole process of, his own family putting him back in there and feeling desperate, So there's some really interesting legacy of resistance and care that's part of that legacy of boarding schools with survival of those young people. My brother and my sister and myself, when we were young, we were with no running water, no electricity, just living up there. And my family didn't want us to go into boarding schools, because that was the only thing. It was Rocky Ridge boarding schools down the road from where we live. And so they moved off the reservation to Flagstaff. So, Kintana occupied Flagstaff, so we could go to school not at a boarding school. And that boarding school is still in operation. If you go there, there's a mural there that has, on one side, it has Diné traditionalism, and this is still up, painted on the wall. It has Diné traditionalism that's portrayed as the devil and devil worship. And then it has the Christianization and that whole assimilation message that's still up in this mural at this boarding school. And so, our family decided to spare us from that. But I have peers that are my age and just a little bit older who went to boarding schools. And a lot of folks don't realize that there are still active boarding schools that have many of these same practices. And just one more note is that, me personally, I don't see a distinction between some of these boarding schools and current colonial education systems. It's just the only thing different today is that we go willingly, that we send our children willingly. Obviously, we're compelled by the state, because you'll face violence if you don't send your kids to school or some kind of economic sanction. But the same assimilation tactics, the same curriculums are employed, and the result, the objective is the same. It's just their methodologies have changed. They're less overtly brutal. But the spiritual violence, in my opinion, is still as intense, if not that much more intensified, because there's a reason. There's a reason that young people, my age and younger, including myself, have had our language as something that has been restricted and something that we don't have that full relationship to because of that intervention. We have a whole generation of our relatives, our parents, that were ashamed to teach and carry on those traditional teachings, our language, our cultures, because of that violence, because of how intensified that and specific that violence was. What I was told by my relatives is that they didn't want to share some stuff because they didn't want us to go through the same things that they faced. And so, yeah, this is the reality that we still carry with us and something that we are still healing from.
Mm-hmm. I mean, gosh, just right down the road here in so-called Flagstaff, there's that Kunklani dormitory, which is basically just where Indigenous children from the res come to stay so that they can go to high school. And I've actually have had some experiences with the children there, and it's kind of just like a little encampment. I don't know if it's really even that different than how it used to be. And you know, just like replacing again, like what we were saying in that history with annihilation from just assimilation, it does make it seem like it's a choice. But when you've been so violently assimilated to the world we live in for centuries now, can it really be considered a choice when, you know, the U.S. is like greatest ideological export, of course, is white supremacy. And so why, you know, we have these like families, I think of my own family, like my mom, you know, we're border natives, and my mom just really wanted to be like a white person, and she went to like Christian schools and stuff like that. And it's hard to sometimes, like, and for people who don't know, she's now a missing Indigenous woman. I really wish I could ask her, like, why did she choose that path? And was it really like a voluntary path? You know, the way that these like Christian and colonial institutions make it seem like it's a choice that we have, when really it's still the case that if that's not the choice that's made, then it's likely that some kind of social annihilation is going to happen. And in my, you know, in my personal experience, I think it could be like a good opportunity for, you know, me to speak specifically about the political tactic of family separation. While I don't know my, you know, Indigenous family's history in regards to residential and boarding schools, I do know that For border natives, family separation is still something that's used to, you know, just continue this, like, I guess, colonial assimilation. So for those who don't know, like, my story is that my mom, like I had just said, kind of wanted to be an American. And so she had me on the U.S. side of the U.S.-Mexico border so I could be an American. And then, you know, like a handful of years go by. She's eventually deported, and because she was a Mexican citizen. And I'm an American citizen, so they kept me in America, where I entered like the foster care system. And when I read and hear stories about people talking about boarding in residential schools, it's really hard for me not to be like, that still exists, and we know it does because the schools literally still exist, but that particular like political strategy exists through like these borders now, where again, like, we were just like sharing the history of some of those quotes, where it was very clear the intention was to place these children into schools. And for me, it's a foster care system where we could be like, you know, made into like productive members of society and lose our culture and lose our history and stuff like that, where very much so the experience in these institutions is still forced assimilation, physical abuse, sexual abuse, just all these, you know, iterations of colonial violence still existing very much in that way. And I just thought it was important to share that in the context of this conversation, so that people understand the various ways that, you know, our genocide is still continued today.
This topic is a little different, considering from where my relations come from. We actually almost have the exact opposite relationship to ancestors than the Dene do. They're present in our everyday life. I won't elaborate on that out of respect to our other people on the podcast, but as such, it means that the deceased amongst our relatives is an ever-present topic. And this particular issue is an ever-present topic because it goes back to literally the origin point of colonialism on this continent, and actually globally as well, but I won't get into that. In the earliest annals of colonial history, basically the diaries and journaling that you can find from conquistadors and friars, this tension with religion and as a force of violence in and of itself, and I mean specifically Christianity, and using it as an impositional product via quote-unquote education, has always been there. It's ever present, and it's been grotesquely entwined with the crawling of colonialism across the continent. The present moment is intriguing in the sense that it's unfortunate it has taken so long, and something so far away, for lack of a better term, you know, in the Vancouver area, in Kamloops, to actually galvanize our own communities to see to take action. This isn't that there hasn't been action taken, but I've never seen it quite spark a fire like it has with everyday people. And it's part of it is the climate of the politicalization of Black Lives Matter, right? But when you delve into the idea of the boarding school and the residential school in particular, and by extension, the mission schools and missions, you actually, it has so many different aspects to it about the violence of this of settler colonialism itself and what we've encountered as we go through it. Because every facet of it is about the total destruction of our being. From what's being taught, to how it's being taught, to where it's being taught, to the systematic process in which families were destroyed, the structure of family was destroyed, children were kidnapped, and the astonishing loss of life. And what hasn't been really discussed in mainstream media, the limited mainstream media that is covering the topic, is very few people are discussing the idea of what's called broken heart syndrome. Broken heart syndrome kind of is a coinage. It is older, probably roughly goes back to the 70s, I believe. But it really came into popular coinage more so in the 90s when they were discussing and doing, when there was a rise in research circa 1992, quincentennial of Columbus, and when at which time where there was massive indigenous organizing and protests going across the entire continent, north, south, central. And what emerged out of that was not a theory, but something, the actual putting into writing and research what we'd only heard stories of that were so painful, the stories themselves, that I can't tell you how many times I was in conversations where the stories would kind of trickle off. They were too painful to discuss. And it wasn't about individualized people. In some cases it was. But what it was is the concept of children in these circumstances being totally isolated, totally alone, totally disconnected, and bombarded with multiple forms of violence with no forms of recourse, including their own language. They can't even speak to one another in their own language. And what resulted was an increased mortality rate, not just based on circumstances of, you know, 18th century or 19th century circumstances that are exposure to disease and lack of medicine and all these other things, but actually the concept of emotional death. And I don't mean emotional death as in someone's being numbed. What I mean is that someone loses the will to live. And that became what were referred to as brokenhearted syndrome, where children would pass away. And they would pass on to the ancestors, and maybe they had a relative that would find out. More often than not, it was a hidden thing, and they wouldn't talk about it or attribute it to something else. But those that came back to their families and their homes would pass on the stories about what had occurred. And it was so common an occurrence that it would show up in people's writings about what was occurring. It would show up in the stories and recollections that people had. And it's a horrifying aspect of the colonial encounter that is such a violent situation that you don't even, that the violence of isolation itself can be made weaponized by something for the strict purposes of breaking an entire body of people in order to transform them into something that we know now could never happen, because white supremacy doesn't allow for anyone but those that it has an interest in serving to be part of that society. So even there is no killing the native to save the man, because we have no potential to ever become quote unquote men or human beings or anything, because there's always a way to backtrack. And then painted over the top of this is the religious connotations, because this was, to use modern language, it was an outsourced project. A project that was outsourced into various church denominations, to certain families that made this into like a racket, and then also state institutions. And then what becomes even more frightening, an extension of this, is that it becomes legitimized over time under the auspices of education. So the very models and institutions and buildings and pedagogy, meaning the science of teaching themselves, which are derived from these periods of time, become systematized nationwide, or actually what are used everywhere. And so at every level of education, including universities and pre-K, if you will, there is residue of what was being taught then, how it was being taught, why it was being taught, the way it was being taught. And is arguably the way to say it is that the totality of education is harm-inducing, because its entire project is based on harm itself as its primary motivational tool, be it justified by religion or justified by the state.
I guess in terms of my relationship with boarding schools, it was something that my family members, aunts, uncles, mother and everything like that were forced to do. And I would hear stories about it all the time. In fact, Shima Sana, she actually, I guess, escaped from all of that. She was back from all of that. She was hidden when these priests and folks and stuff like that, these monsters would come. And she was designated in her family as somebody that was supposed to, that knew all of the songs, the ceremonies, things like that. And so she was kept from that. And I think that was probably a good thing for us. But our family didn't escape that. In fact, I would hear these horror stories from various members of my family. And in terms of the what was brought up prior to the family separation, that's key. You know, I think the legacies, the bloody legacies, the traumatic legacies of these boarding schools echoes far beyond just those generations. I think that what happened there, and especially in these schools and stuff like that, was designed with the strict intent to, you know, kill all of our people, and in various forms and bastions. And I think that where I can speak from is that, you know, a lot of that trauma that we've been talking about, a lot of that is sexual trauma too. And so being a victim and a survivor myself from those legacies that have been unfortunately passed on to me. So I think it's really important that we make these connections with, I guess, missing and murdered Indigenous relatives, because a lot of, I think, speaking from a personal standpoint, the escape, the numbness that I guess you want to feel when these thoughts or whatever they be, emotions or whatever, come up, you know, you want to escape that. You know, it's not something that you really want to like stay focused on for too long. And I think that a part of missing and murdered Indigenous relatives, I think there's a part of that that is dedicated to these residential schools, these boarding schools, these Catholic schools, these schools that were intent upon killing us in various ways. And so within these communities, we have folks that have, you know, suffered that. Sometimes they replicate those things too. And speaking as a survivor, you know, it's really hard to come back from some of these experiences. So I can understand people wanting to escape and things like that. People wanting to get away from, you know, the very culture or whatever it is. Because I know that, like, you know, for me as a person that, you know, didn't would see some of these people, you know, partaking in ceremony, and we know these things about some of these folks that perpetuate these things in our own community, it's really hard to engage in that type of healing that is ceremony when you have people that partake in these that are perpetuating some of these things. So it's a long journey, I think, for a lot of folks, but it isn't just what happened, you know, to one, two, three generations before. It's the legacy that goes on, that echoes through the generations that come afterwards. And so, you know, there's different parts of trauma that I think all lead to people wanting to escape, you know, leave the res, you know, not feel these things. And sometimes people look into other things, substances, to, you know, facilitate that. And these are all personal experiences too. So, you know, it's a hard road, I think, that a lot of people don't really understand the echoes and how this reverberates throughout generations. And so, I think that, you know, when we talk about organizing community, when we talk about, you know, organizing in general, how do we organize community or a larger scale if we don't have some of these elements, you know, taken care of within our own community? You know, these people that are still part of these communities that perpetuate it, whether it be an institution like a boarding school, you know, a church that's inside of a Native community. So I go back to that quote that says that the child that, what is it, is not welcome or embraced by the community, they will warm themselves in the ashes of it. I think that, you know, when you see these fires, that's part of it. So I think that, you know, just when you look at, you know, destroying some of these things or these destroyed institutions, you know, for some of us, you know, we'll warm our hands on that for sure. And those that try to uplift that, or those that try to validate those things, or those that maybe try and perpetuate some of those, you know, behaviors that came from that, because these things are all genocidal. You know, when Columbus landed, first thing he did, separate the children from the adults. You know, some of them were forced to work, mine. The others were sex slaves. And so these are our first contacts with European culture. And boarding schools are colonial. These are all colonial viruses. These are all colonial plagues. And, you know, how do we stop that virus in the sense of what we're dealing with today? You know, and I think that if we're not making these connections, then we're really doing a disservice to a lot of the survivors or those that can't speak. You know, maybe the trauma is too great. You know, I've been in all these circles and, you know, trying to find connection or something that resonates, you know, is hard. You know, climbing out of that, you know, is also pretty hard. But I think that, you know, these are necessary in terms of like what we have to eradicate from our lands. All these institutions, whether they be, you know, churches, whether they be governments, whether they be nonprofits, whatever they are, these things are all parasitic. And, you know, I think that that is my personal, I guess, relationship to the boarding schools and residential schools, things like that. And I think that, you know, some of these folks that are a part of that, you know, I just don't really understand history. But I think that platforms, books, these are all great ways to understand and learn and educate ourselves. So I guess I really didn't expect to go this far into this, but I wanted to make some connections when we're talking about boarding schools. I think that the sexual violence portion of that conversation isn't talked about enough, and I think it resonates throughout movements like, you know, missing and murdered Indigenous relatives, things like that. That's a piece of it, because whether or not they were part of the boarding school, they probably felt the effects from it, whether that be from, you know, a relative or a family friend or any of these things. So I wanted to make that connection, especially for those that are on the reservation that may have, you know, experienced something similar, because I think that, you know, when we talk about cleaning up the res and doing right by our land and things like that, cleaning up the res should also include like eradicating these colonial entities. Cleaning up the res looks like, you know, taking out these predators and these pedophiles, things like that. That should also be a part of all of that. And so that is, I guess, my little take on that, my little piece, but I just wanted to, I guess, share that in along with y'all.
Thanks, Remy. I was gonna follow up and just say that I appreciate the emphasis on the connection between the gender-based violence, because absolutely these schools were absolutely I would consider the birthplace for just the level of sexual violence that exists in our indigenous communities today. Absolutely stems from the experiences of these residential and boarding schools. And I also wanted to just kind of add to the conversation around gender-based violence, that like just a complete like annihilation of queerness that was like you know, part of this assimilation and that happening in in the schools too. The connection between residential schools and gender-based violence and queer phobia is all so relevant to how a queer Indigenous person might operate in the world today, and it's really fucking scary.
I wanted to thank you, Remy, for sharing and just opening up that way. It's really, I think, something that in this issue, particularly when we talk about intergenerational trauma, this is what we mean, you know, and we don't have a lot of spaces that provide the opportunity for us to address these issues. And I think that that's why there's such a powerful moment that has been opened up to have these discussions and to have extended talking circles in some ways. And it's interesting how that is overflowing on social media because of these platforms for folks to have that visibility and to be affirmed, to be validated and understood and find that solidarity and connection. I think part of the question that you raised is very clear and necessary, you know, because we're talking about the brutal horrors of assimilation through forced education and the violence that has come along with that genocidal legacy. So the question we have is, you know, how can we face how its ongoing legacy continues to fulfill its vicious objectives and stop that and heal from that? And to me, that's where, as you brought up, and for the listeners who aren't aware, Remy's talking about the churches that are burning in so-called Canada. So far, as far as the reports that I've seen, there's been about 48 Christian churches in so-called Canada that have either been burned down or vandalized. And, you know, there's not a clear link as far as the arsons are concerned to the residential school issues, but there's no manifestos or no notes, but there is a clear correlation to the time and the accountability that the culpability that the church has, the blood on the church's hands. So, you know, the vandalization that people are saying is happening, what we're seeing is red hands and, you know, statements about the brutal legacy and the responsibility, the blood on the hands that the church has had. And so to me, this is where, you know, I am fascinated with this power of Indigenous rage and how it is being expressed in terms of vengeance, not just by radical folks or, you know, extreme folks, but people who have survived this and who recognize that, you know, when we hear about these calls for more acknowledgments of this suffering, right, from settlers. We want settlers to see us, to understand how valid our, you know, brutal experiences at their hands. Like, is that enough? We want, you know, people are calling for apologies by these institutions. Is that enough? I hear people also calling to honor treaties, which is a bit absurd because, you know, if you actually read the Dinette Treaty of 1868, it actually has compulsory education. It actually paved the way for further brutal, forced, colonial education. You know, the honoring the treaties isn't something that we should be considering if we're actually addressing this legacy. you know, people are calling for better history lessons or for reconciliation. And I think that, you know, there have been actually some powerful pushbacks by some groups organizing in so-called Canada. There was a group that was called the Truth Commission into Genocide in Canada, so-called Canada, where they responded after, I think, in 2007, after decades of advocacy for reparations. There was actually a settlement agreed upon in the largest class action settlement. And that was, I think it included a $10,000 common experience payment to approximately 90,000 people who survived residential schools, with an additional $3,000 for every year that they were held at the schools. So there was approximately $2 million that was advocated for funding for healing and educational programs. So that was part of the answer, that the colonial state of so-called Canada had to reconcile for reparations this issue. And so there was a group actually called the Truth Commission into Genocide in Canada, which charged that residential schools were responsible for the deaths and disappearances of thousands of Indigenous people. And they rejected that deal by saying, quote, "This bribe and legal gagging is being presented as a final resolution of the claims of residential school survivors, as if such unspeakable crimes as mass sterilizations, gang rape, ritualistic torture, and murder are resolvable or by or reducible to an issue of money." And so I think that that was a powerful rejection of those terms, and something that, again, is part of that question of so yes, what does justice look like? What, you know, in this moment, you know, Indigenous vengeance in terms of striking at these churches, which are part of the root of this brutality, and especially as Anthony has contextualized.
I like that you hit on this idea of fury, because I think that that's actually one of the, it's kind of awkward how we've gotten to this point in terms of the discussion of the subject, not just because it isn't just the boarding schools as phenomenon, it's it and what everything else that encompasses it coming into being, right? So like, for example, once you delve into it, I believe that at the center of there's a tension at the center of all of this that isn't just about the victim, quote unquote, but not that I want to decenter victims. I'm just saying that at the center of it is there's those of us that may pursue healing. There are those of us that believe that healing and injustice can never happen. And then there are those of us that want to embrace a lane of destroy the institution of destruction. You know, like we believe that, you know, the Indian Wars never ended. And arguably that's true, because to just think of these residential schools as like a follied educational project full of toxic people is to misunderstand and decontextualize it from how they initially emerged. All of them emerged as a weapon, every single one of them, and directly connected to the outcomes of warfare. It wasn't, that's not a nebulous thing. That's not a guess. That's not an opinion. It's a fact. Every single one of them are a result of that. And what's come over time is just seen as, you know, by the mainstream at best, as an out of control violent institution. You know, like that was the bad priest or the bad teacher or the abuser or whatever, and there's no responsibility, and is there a responsibility to be taken for that and what it produces, be it those that are actually everyone that has been harmed by it in our communities, and either perpetuators of harm themselves or self-harm, or those that actually find themselves needing to find the tools and other ways to fight back, and finding ways to do that. And it's my concern, and the reason I bring that up is I think the fury and the fire, and I don't pick those two things, you know, those two terms up lightly. I think the fury and the fire are intimately connected and should be, and also should be fueled. Because what we have seen in this particular, we're in a delicate moment where one acknowledgement is occurring, this idea where that this institution is being seen as the house of horrors and charnel house that it really is, as well as we are, I don't, you don't even like this term, but kind of we're reclaiming our ancestors as well and trying to put them to rest in a traditional way, in some kind of form of closure of a type. But beyond that, on the periphery, and already Klee discussed it a little bit, is this idea of truth and reconciliation. What's misunderstood and what I don't like about the way certain people approach it is truth and reconciliation has never been the beginning point. It's been the after point that has been utilized to pacify movements. It has never been utilized to actually as a liberatory project. It's been utilized in order to undermine the liberatory project and to kind of make sure and soft pedal colonialism and the things as they are, the status quo, if you will, in as kind of a, well, see, now we've seen it, we've acknowledged it, and we hear you and you hear us, and therefore it's all good. And it isn't all good, because the power relation doesn't change. The ongoing violence hasn't changed. And this is a settler project that is, like I said, ongoing and is deeply multifaceted. It is not as simple as a school or a particular student. It goes well beyond into everything that it represents, the impulse to do it, the impulse that still currently exists. It's not like the impulse for assimilation that, for example, targets quote unquote immigrants, isn't the same impulse that is trying to remove the savage and to create the man. It's the exact same impulse. This idea of cultural supremacy is imposed on other people. My concern then becomes, if what occurs when all of the I don't want to say triggers, but like signifiers, if you will, the maneuvering space for action is either not direct action or is deviating therefrom, away from direct action. And the reason I bring that up, and I'd say it's delicate, is because in the 90s, and actually it really kind of started in the 80s and out of the Red Power movement, what came out of the Red Power movement and was actually part of it almost at the beginning was elements of kind of group therapy around substance abuse and stuff like that. As we got into the late 80s and early 90s, and there was an emergence of spaces, what we would call today, quote unquote, safe spaces, in which Indigenous people could tell their story as related to residential schools and boarding schools, we discovered that, and I speak the we as in the movement, quote unquote, discovered that trauma had to be tended to as well. In other words, militancy wasn't just enough. And then attached to that came all the ancillary things of undealt with trauma, intergenerational trauma, be it the violence, the self-violence or addiction, and of wide variety of things that were connected to it. And that still isn't tending to the schools itself. In a weird way, a lot of the problems with the school were a result of just capitalism, making it so that that they were either unfunded, defunded, but I can't say it was a result of a movement that actually hasn't occurred. And so that's why I bring that up, is that on the one hand, there is the population of our relatives, that this is part of their lived experience and has needs tending to. And then the other part is the institution and the institutional memory and how this connects to colonialism that also should be combated against. So one is a front line and the other is kind of at home. And so my big concern, I feel like I'm repeating myself, is how the two of them get balanced as the issue itself or the consciousness around the issue moves forward, and what those doing the work are doing as well. Oh, and being concerned that it instead gets pacified or used into a pacification project.
Well, and this is sort of what I was bringing up a moment ago. And I think that it's exemplified through what Department of Interior Secretary Deb Haaland announced in June, which was a federal Indian boarding school initiative. The Department of Interior basically said that it's going to...
The following is a previously broadcast program.
C'est Alex qui vous parle pour votre émission Café sur les ondes de CKUT. Je vous parle donc en direct de mon studio maison et ce soir, nous avons eu la brillante idée d'enregistrer une partie de l'émission par Zoom avec Anthony qui est en direct de son chalet. Hein?
On dit maison d'été ici.
Oh, maison d'été!
Nous sommes des aristocrates et de maison d'été. Donc, je suis très bien, ceci étant dit.
Chanceux. On t'envie ici parce qu'à Montréal, on meurt de chaleur.
J'invite tout le monde à venir se baigner. On a une rivière quand même froide proche.
OK, c'est entendu.
Mais je dis pas c'est où.
C'est bon. OK, donc au menu ce soir pour l'émission, Esther B s'est entretenue avec le chercheur basé à Hong Kong, François Mouillot, à propos de son livre « Fractured Scenes, Underground Music Making in Hong Kong and East Asia », donc ouvrage qui explore la scène méconnue de la musique underground à Hong Kong.
Wow!
Et sinon, je vous propose d'explorer la programmation estivale de deux salles cinématographiques montréalaises, celle du cinéma public